Okay. Well, we had...
Let me get situated here.
We had left off. We are still in Judges. And just as I thought I would for sure guarantee us we'd get out of this time frame, I'm not sure we will, but we'll get close. So depending on how quickly we move through it, there are a lot of good stories. And so I don't want to race through it. I think it's important, but I want to make sure we don't get bogged down too much. So it's always good to have visitors. We've got a couple coming in, so that's good. All right, so we are in the book of Judges. And if you want to turn with me, we'll spend some time in Judges today. We left off in Judges 3 and 4. And we had just left off with Deborah and Barak and talked a little bit about Deborah and Barak. Deborah being a prophetess and her leadership role. We talked about how how Deborah had kind of asked Barak to go lead, and he said, sure, no problem, as long as you will come. And so we went through that story, and we left off, though, there in verse 20, where Barak nor his men had killed the Canaanite leaders of Sisera. And so they had fled the scene, and you know all their soldiers had died, but they had fled. And so they marched after them. We know that that he was then later killed by Jael, who drove the tent peg through his temple as he was asleep in the tent. And so here we are. We are in chapter 5, and we have a we get some details here through a song, which is kind of interesting. Deborah and Barak did some singing of praise here, and so we have this song, and there's kind of a historical review when you read through, and I'm just hitting the high points again, so anybody that wants to make comments, we have some visitors arrive, please interrupt if you need to. But in verses 4 and 5, there's a historical review of the Lord's marching from Seir and Edom, and but what do we see that God offered here in these two verses? You know, we know that as the children were marching through and conquering groups, the Lord was on their side at times. And when He was, we saw some pretty interesting things happen. Well, what happens here? Does anybody remember part of this story of how He assisted them? Because we see some natural things happen. Well, in this chapter, in this book, we see where there was a major, I guess we'd call it a gully washer, a massive storm, probably about like what we just got hit with the other day, just a fast, furious rain, and the earth was trembling, the heavens had poured out, the clouds poured down water, and the mountains gushed before the Lord. And we know that we read before about how the children of Israel were very fearful of the chariots. Karen had talked to us about that being the latest, greatest thing, and they were of iron. Is that what it was? Iron. And so they were, you know, it's very hard on foot to go against a chariot. But how well do you think the chariots would handle rain like this? Not very well. We talked about the chariots having trouble on hills anyway. Well, now, can you imagine it's poured rain, so it's a muddy mess. Have you ever gotten a car out in a muddy mess? It doesn't even work well, let alone a chariot. So, you know, they had issues here. I guess you could say they were dead in the water, so to speak. So we go on in verses 6 through 8. You have this historical review, and you get some more details about Deborah rising as a deliverer. Verse 7, let's read verse 7. I want to pause here for a second. Village life ceased. It ceased in Israel until I, Deborah, arose a mother in Israel. That statement, arose a mother in Israel. Does anybody know, do we see this a lot in the Bible? And the answer really is no. I think I can only find one other place. But what exactly is meant here? Does anyone have any thoughts? Because we only see it here in 2 Samuel chapter 20.
Well, God raised her up to be a judge the same as He raised up the other judges.
Yeah.
And so I assume that's just a reference to
kind of her leadership role.
Her authority given to her by God.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of the way I read it, is that she's going to be the mother of, or the caretaker of, or the leader, the judge. We know she was a prophetess. It's just an interesting statement. I don't know. But again, it's only made one other time, and I don't know if there's anything to make of it. It's unusual. Yeah. No, I know. Yeah.
Role as a mother.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because you know she wasn't the only mother, but was she unique in the fact that she was a mother and then a leader and a judge and a prophetess, which we know wasn't common. So maybe that was why the reference. Maybe. To make reference of her, you mean being just a common mother? Yeah, I don't know. Interesting statement. Okay, and then not to get bogged down in this story, but you know, we've got verses 10 through 18 was a call to worship, and they described some of the battle here in some terms, some pretty specific, or just general terms, I'm sorry. In verses 14 and 15 and 18, the tribes who heeded Deborah's call. So we know that they listened to her, they heeded her call, and we read there in those passages where 10 of the 12 tribes are mentioned. So we have 10 of the 12 tribes mentioned here. 5.5 of those tribes, you might say, were favorably mentioned because they had responded to Deborah's summons. So not everyone did. 4.5 tribes are criticized because they didn't join the other Israelites. So we have Reuben, Gad, Dan, Asher, and the eastern Manasseh that was mentioned that did not. And again, just some details of, you know, just reading through who was following her and who wasn't. Verses 19 through 23, the victory that she has here is described way much more, you know, in more detail. There's a curse pronounced on Meroz, I guess, if I'm saying that right, Meroz, which is otherwise, like if you read about this, and again, I don't know if I'm saying it right, Meroz, I don't see it mentioned anywhere else in the Bible. Which is kind of interesting, but we have this site being mentioned here, and I think it's the only place we see it. And then I think it's interesting that if you go down to verse 20, and I want to read this and have comment again on this. They fought from the heavens, the stars from their courses fought against Sisera. Of course, we're talking. So it says the kings, back up verse 19, the kings came and fought, the kings of Canaan fought in Tanakh by the waters of Megiddon. They took no spoils of silver. They fought from the heavens, the stars from their courses fought against Sisera. What does it mean that they fought from the heavens? Is this God being on their side? I think it's one way of looking at it. From the heavens, the stars also fought. You know, we see numerous times in the book of Joshua and Judges, as we read through there, that, you know, the Lord was on their side, and I think this is just one more way of kind of furthering that point. Again, kind of an interesting way of saying it. So the end of the song is a contrast between two women. So remember, we're reading about a song here that Deborah and Barak had. The end of the song, this contrast there in verses 24 through 27 is about Jael, who killed Sisera. And then her mother, who is in verses 28 through 30, who longed for his return. So the passage shows Sisera's mother for the first time as she waited for him. So that's kind of the way we end that chapter. And then after we have Deborah and Barak, we have Gideon being called. And I say after. Remember, not everything was chronological. But we read of Gideon being called here. As with every single time we've talked about this, they're on the Lord's side and they turn their back. Israel has now done evil in the sight of the Lord and has now been delivered into the hands of Midian for 7 years. So they're back in this cyclical behavior that we talk about. And so we read here in this chapter where the children would sow their crops, and the Amalekites and the Midianites, I mean, it's just kind of a frustrating thing. They would just come up and destroy their produce. So they would, I don't know about any of you, but if you've ever planted a garden, and an animal gets in and eats it or destroys it, it's pretty frustrating. Imagine planting it and then knowing that other people come up and eat from it, tear it up, burn it, trash it. It'd be pretty tough. So not only do you feel oppressed, but they've kind of gone up against the mountain. You get the feeling that their back is against the wall kind of thing. And then here they are having their food and crops just destroyed. So if we go to chapter 6, verses 5 and 6, let's just read that. It's kind of interesting. It says, "For they would come up with their livestock and their tents," and I'm talking about the Amalekites and Midianites here, "coming up in as numerous as locusts. Both they and their camels were without number, and they would enter the land to destroy it. So Israel had greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord." Okay, so here we get a pretty bleak, low feeling. You know, and we talked about this last week, and we've talked about it, but how they would go through these cycles, but they wouldn't turn to God immediately. I mean, they would get themselves all the way till you hit rock bottom. And again, and we're trying to pause on life's lessons for us, but that's not when we should be waiting to reach out to God, is it? You know, we don't wait till we hit rock bottom. Now, unfortunately, as human beings, for some reason, we put things off until the bitter end, until you realize you just, I guess you have to hit bottom sometimes. We've seen people that have drug addictions or whatever, and that's what has to happen. They get, you know, get to the lowest of low before they realize they've got to do something about it. And that's what they would do, though. They would get themselves to the point where they had nothing going for them, and they were impoverished, as it says here. And then finally, what do? Cry aloud. Well, that was 7 years. Finally, they cried out to the Lord to deliver them up and have Gideon help them deliver them. So they're in chapter 6. Will somebody read verses 11 through 14? This is where Gideon's actually called.
"Now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abizurite, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, 'The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor.' Gideon said to him, 'O my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, Did not the Lord bring us from Egypt? But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites.' And the Lord turned to him and said, 'Go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you?'"
Okay. So here we have Gideon basically being called up, and the angel of the Lord comes to him, and he does probably what every single one of us would do. Even though he's saying, "Oh, the Lord's with you," he's saying, "Okay, are you sure? Can you give me a sign?" So he goes into asking for a sign, which we see in time. He's not the first one to ask for that. And so, does anyone remember what sign Gideon asked for, or what he got? If you read on down through 19 through 23, does anybody remember?
He makes a sacrifice of gold.
Okay. All right. So you think that's sign enough? Can you imagine? That would probably make you realize, okay, yep, I guess I got what I needed. Here we go. So what does Gideon do next? Now that he's had this sign, does anybody remember? And I'm just going to try to keep us from reading details, see if we can recite them. What does Gideon do? So he's got this sign. Anybody remember?
He builds an altar and tears down some other
altars. Okay. All right. And what did he do to tear down those altars? Anybody remember? He took his father's bull, and then he got another bull of 7 years. Again, I don't know. Some of these details are funny that they give. But and tears down this altar of Baal. And then there was a wooden image beside it. I don't know that it tells us what it is anywhere else. But he took 10 men and did what the Lord asked him to do. But anyway, he gets these two bulls. So he gets his father's bull and then another bull of 7 years, and he tears these altars down. On that day, does anybody remember what he was called after this was done? What was another name for Gideon? Does anybody remember?
Zerubbabel.
Okay. And we see him kind of from here on out references Zerubbabel. So all the Midianites and Amalekites, they gather together. But the Spirit of the Lord was with who? Gideon. And so He blew a horn, and the Abrazites gathered behind him. So he had kind of a following. There was a presence. So the Abrazites gathered behind him. They sent the message throughout the land, and the others gathered to back him. So we have this group of people that would we're going to show support, that we're with Gideon. And I'm going to read verses 36 through 40. I think it's a good, important part. Then Gideon said to God, "If you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, look, I shall put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor." So we know this story. I won't read it all. But so what's he ask of this fleece? Is it, remember, another test for God here? Okay. Yep. And then did that seem to be enough? No. So, which is so funny. You know, here we just tested to know. You know, he asked. I think it's interesting. And I, you know, do we do similar things? I mean, for whatever reason, we lose faith. I mean, how do we lose faith? You read this story and you go, but Gideon, just a short few verses, a chapter ago, you had tested and the angel of the Lord passed it. And you knew he was on your side, so why are you asking again? But he did. So he puts fleece out and asked for, was it the fleece to be wet first, the ground dry? Is that right? Yeah. And then inverse it, because that test wasn't enough. And so, and then verse 40, it says, "And God did so that night. It was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew on all the ground." So that happens. And, yeah.
Also see happen inside of Jesus that miracles don't really build faith. And you would think that the opposite would be true, yeah. But it just time and time again, the children of Israel, they walk through
they
the
saw everything.
And then what happens? Then they sacrifice to an idol. You and I would think that we would never do that, but time and time again, that's exactly what happens. The miracle happens, and for whatever reason, it just doesn't build faith.
Yeah. So, I think another great point for, do we need miracles today?
No.
We don't.
I think it's one of the reasons that we have, when Christ instituted the Lord's Supper, to be partaken of every first day of the week, instead of once a month, yeah, or once a year, etc., because we're humans just like they were humans.
That's right.
And if you continue, like Ben said, to build your faith,
just off these
day
big,
by
yeah,
day,
yeah.
Then it's different than remembering once a year.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Okay. All right. So we're in chapter 7. Any other comments or questions before we get into this? So we see here the Midianites were defeated. And how were the Midianites defeated? As we get into this chapter, when we started off, there was too many people, right? So we know this story. There's too many people, and does anybody remember how many we started with? Was it 22,000 to start, I think? And so then he says, hey, there's way too many, so if anybody's fearful, 32,000. And then, yeah, so those who are fearful, let them go ahead. So that 10,000 left at that, which got us to 22,000, thanks. And then the next thing was bring them down to the water, which was the story about where they either were going to lap it up like a dog, or they would, cup it, I guess, in their hand. And so that cut left how many? So we were down to 10,000, and from 10,000 we ended up with how many?
300.
Okay. So 300, and what's the Lord say? That's enough. We'll be just fine. So he broke those 300 men into three companies of 100 each. And what three things, we learned this little kids, but what three things did they make sure they were equipped with? Does anybody remember?
Lantern.
Okay.
Pictures.
Okay. Trumpet. Trumpet. Yep. Yeah. So yeah, I guess you could say kind of like a sword. It is. that was their sword. So think about this. Can you imagine going? And again, this is what we've talked about. But they're going to 300 men. You know good and well 300 men shouldn't be able to do it. And they go in with a trumpet, absolutely harmless, a pitcher, and a torch, or a lantern, as Mike says. Okay? That shouldn't get it done. But we know that, again, proving the point that if God's on their side, it's possible. So they blew their trumpets, they broke their pitchers, and they held their torches and yelled. Does anybody remember what they yelled? What was it they were commanded to yell?
Rejoice.
Okay, the sword of the Lord and Gideon. Okay, so you yell that out, and that's going to do the trick. Now, I'm trying to put myself in their shoes. Can you imagine thinking, there's 300 of us, and we've got these three items, we're going to go take them. Going into battle is scary enough, I can't imagine. But again, this just reminds you, if the Lord's on your side, you shouldn't be worried. But every man stood their place in the camp, did exactly what was told of them, and as the army ran out, they fled and basically killed themselves. But read in, somebody read verses 23 through 25, there in chapter 7.
When the 300 trumpets sounded, the Lord caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with their swords. The army fled to Beth Shittah toward Zerah, as far as the border of Abel Meholah near Kadesh. Israelites from Naphtali, Asher, and all Manasseh were called out, and they pursued the Midianites. Gideon sent messengers throughout the hill country of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites and seize the waters of the Jordan ahead of them as far as Beth-Pharah." So all the men of Ephraim were called out, and they took the waters of the Jordan as far as Beth-Pharah. They also captured two of the Midianite leaders, Oreb and Zeeb. They killed Oreb at the Rock of Oreb and Zeeb at the Winepress of Zeeb. They pursued the Midianites and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeeb to Gideon, who was by the Jordan.
Okay. So, chase them out. They go after the heads of these leaders, Oreb and Zeeb. They killed them, brought the heads back to Gideon to prove we've done what you asked. Yeah.
So, it says they seized all the watering places. Does that mean that they just held that until they gave up?
Or did they take control for good?
Weren't able to fight and kill them?
I don't know. That's you read that, and we all know that water at that time was going to be an important thing. And like you say, if you had control of the water, and they're going to try to get there to drink, and you didn't have anything to drink,
you'd have to either surrender or fight to
till you die. Yeah.
You know, you couldn't have water.
Right. Yeah. Kind of interesting. So that's an interesting little detail. But yeah, I read that about the same thing. I think they controlled it until you got to get a drink. So what are you going to do? You're either going to fight and try to get to that water or surrender. Kind of interesting. Okay, chapter 8. So just to hit some of the high points, Gideon and his 300 men came to the Jordan, and they crossed over. Gideon said to the men of Succoth, "Give us loaves of bread for the people who follow me." And he informed them that they were pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of Midian. So he tells them this. He says, "Hey, we're pursuing these guys, and so can you give my men that's behind me bread?" And so what do the leaders of Succoth say to Gideon? Does anybody remember? I think this is kind of an interesting story. They get a little bit smart with Gideon here, and they say, "Well, hey, do you have custody of those two men?" And he basically says, "No, and I'm paraphrasing him, but we're pursuing them." And so let's read in chapter 8. I'll read it, verses 7 and 8. So Gideon said, "For this cause, when the Lord has delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with the briars." Then he went up from there to Peniel and spoke to them in the same way. And the men of Peniel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered him. So he basically comes into these people saying, "Hey, can you take care of my men? Can you feed them?" And they're like, "Do you have custody of them?" "Well, no. We're pursuing them." "Oh, okay." And they act like, "Well, if you had custody, we'd feed you, but we don't. So you're on your own." And he says, "You're going to pay." So I think it's kind of interesting, and we're going to get to that. But he goes on to the next group, and they say the same thing. Now they answer just like them. So after Gideon returned from capturing Zeba and Zalmunna, did you have any wonder that he would go back and repay them? No. He returned from battle to repay those that wouldn't give him the bread. So somebody read verses. Well, I'll read it. I got the mic. 14 through 17. And he caught a young man of the men of Succoth and interrogated him. And he wrote down for him the leaders of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. Then he came to the men of Succoth and said, "Here are Zeba and Zalmunna, about whom you ridiculed me, saying, 'Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand, that we would give bread to your weary men?'" So he's reminding them. You remember when you asked me, "Do you have these men?" And I had to say no at that time. Well, now I have them. And he says, "And he took the leaders of the city and the thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. Then he tore down the tower of Peniel and killed the men of that city." And he said to Ziba and Zalmunna, "What kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor?" So they answered, and I've read one too many. But bottom line is, he went back and took care of them just like he said he would. And then some, I guess. So was everything great for Gideon at this point? I mean, was Gideon... Yeah, Ben.
Let's bring it too far.
Sure.
I'm just curious. So Gideon clearly kills the people of
that, yeah.
He said, "I'm going to come tear down." He asked the same thing. He's supposed to tear down the tower and kill them.
Uh huh.
So, does Gideon kill the elders of Succoth, or does he just like whip them with these briars? He said he's going to tear their flesh.
Yeah, he said he was, but
we might not know.
Go ahead.
That term
that he yeah, I think he did a little more than tear their flesh.
I'm thinking about when I was
taught. Yeah, with the switch. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I read that to mean that he was going to force them out into the desert where they would die, but maybe not.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, if someone's tearing your flesh or harming you to the point of that, like you say, it might drive them out, but I think in the end they were killed. But yeah, I think they... The lesson was taught, and they paid probably more of a price than just their skin being torn, like he, of the briars. Which, either way, I'm sure it was nasty. He let them know that you should have helped us. You had a chance. Okay. Let's see here. Where did I leave off? So, everything wasn't great, though, for Gideon. I mean, it felt like things were going well. He was praised by the men of Israel. So, this is kind of an important point. He was praised by the men of Israel, and they... what did they want at this time? So we're getting into kind of a transition period, but what did they want here? They wanted to be under his rule. They wanted to be under his son's rule. Because why? Well, he had delivered them from the hands of Midian. So, we want you to rule over us. So Gideon says the right thing here, because as you're reading, you're thinking, oh, he's going to mess this up. He doesn't. So he says, no, I'm not going to rule over you, and my sons aren't going to rule over you. Only God will rule over you. So he does the right thing here, and you're thinking, okay, good job, Gideon. You nailed it. But then what does he do right after this? So you remember, they've had this battle. They've slaughtered tons. He asks for the earrings they collected from the war. Just the earrings, which is interesting. So look around the audience. The women wearing earrings. They're little. They're dainty. But what's he say? So by he captures these things in kind of a sheet of a thing. And just the earrings totaled 1,700 shekels of gold. That gives you an idea. Of course, I know there was, I think everybody at this time probably had earrings or rings of some sort. Gideon used that gold to do what? Make an ephod in the city. Okay? So all of Israel, it says, played the harlot there, and it became a snare to who? Gideon and his household. Sad. What a sad deal. So things are going great. Lord leads us to victory. I just need the earrings. We're going to melt those down, and I'm going to make an ephod.
And this is kind of the same thing, that happened to Solomon. If you read down a few more verses, he had many wives and concubines, and basically he converted to idolatry.
Right.
And I think, though, Israel had 40 years of rest while Gideon was alive.
They did, yeah.
I think from the time that they conquered the Midianites.
Things were good.
There was a long period of time there that this took place where they
for a time. Yeah.
I mean, it seems that it was.
I don't know that it happened overnight, like you say, but he makes this ephod. And,
but Gideon kind of went the same direction as Solomon.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. And someone, what is an ephod? I had to look it up, kind of forgot.
Breastplate.
Like a breastplate, yeah, a vest. A vest, a vest or a breastplate. Okay. He makes it out of this gold, and which is interesting. Why would this breastplate cause him a problem? And was it just the breastplate? I mean, it mentions that, but it says Gideon and his whole household, became a snare to them.
I would think that he probably had good intentions when he did that. Kind of like Saul, offered a sacrifice when he wasn't answered. He wasn't supposed to do that.
Right.
The priests are supposed to do that.
But he was
all paid for that. And it would seem, it seems to me here that Gideon
probably had a decent intention.
Yeah, so I'll just ephod. I mean, I'm just thinking that that's what it is. But it was not right. Like Larry said, he wasn't supposed to do that.
Right.
And eventually, Israel apparently used that as idolatrous worship.
Yeah. And we know, and that's a great point, but when we deviate and do our what we think is right in our own eyes, it doesn't work. It's not good. So, you know, we read of multiple examples, and Mike just mentioned a couple there, but, you know, we read of men of valor that seemingly had a good intention. You know, I'm going to consecrate this thing to the God. We had a great victory. We're just going to melt down the earrings, and we'll make this ephod. But then later we see it being a snare for him and his household. So if you read in the very end of chapter 8, verses 33 to 35, let's read at the end here, it says, "And it was so, as soon as Gideon was dead, that the children of Israel again played the harlot with Baal, and made Baal-Berith their god. Thus the children of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of their enemies on every side. Nor did they show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal," which was Gideon, "in accordance with the good he had done for Israel." And we're back again. And the cycle continues. So, Gideon dies off. The children again do the same thing. They revert back. And the cycle is back on. Okay.
Not only did they not do good to his house, yeah, the next chapter we see where he killed them.
That's right.
They were all put to death.
Yep. Yep. We're getting ready to get into Abimelech. So, the Abimelech was the son of Gideon, son of Jezebel. Chapter 9 is an interesting chapter, and we may try to end on this, but just to kind of try to recap verses, I guess we'd say chapter 9, 1 through 6, Abimelech wanted to do what? What was his goal? He wanted to take his father's place, and so what does Abimelech do? And if I read this and understand this right, because it's a little confusing, he goes to his mother's brother, I guess you'd say, and they convince the men of Shechem to support Abimelech in killing who? Well, his father. Yeah, his father's family, his brothers. And how many brothers did he have, or half-brothers, because his brothers and half-brothers? Well, you read on, you find out it was 70. And what did they give him to try to make this happen? They gave him 70... shekels of silver. Well, where did that 70 shekels of silver come from? From the temple of Baal. So we know we're off to a pretty bad start right here, but if he gets these 70 shekels of silver from the townsman here, and what's he do with these 70 shekels of silver? Well, he's got to go out and hire some people. So who's he hire? Some real good people? Well, it describes them as worthless, reckless men. Okay, good. Well, he's got some good guys on his side. This is going to work out great. So what's he do? He goes and kills off his brothers. He kills off 70. But, I say 70. I guess in theory it might have been 69. Because one brother, and I need to double check that. I can't remember. I thought it was 70. So maybe he did kill off 70. So he may have had 71 brothers. But his one brother, Jotham, went and hid. So this one brother goes and hides. He doesn't end up killing him. And then... what does, and that brings us basically to verse 7 there in chapter 9. And if you've read this before, and I've read it and reread it and read it, but we've got this, my Bible, the heading is a revelation of Jotham, so I don't know if you want to call it a revelation or a parable of some sort. But if you've read ahead, does anyone know what this revelation or this parable means? So we get into this this revelation of the trees, which... I'm going to say represents his 70 sons. And then it talks about this olive tree. Well, what do we know about the olive tree at that time? Well, it was important, played an important role. It was profitable. I mean, it was probably one that all landowners would have had or wanted. And probably in the day, there was no other equal for medicine or food or whatever. And... you know, it was a good one. Of course, then we read of the fig tree as one of the probably most fruitful trees that they had, and it yielded probably the, I guess, most delicious fruit, possibly. I mean, that's probably up for debate, but it had been a good tree, a good sweet fruit to eat. And then we read of this thorn bush. Well, I think that represents, and again, I'm telling you I think, because I'm just giving you what I believe to be right. We're not going to get into it today, and maybe you can read it this weekend, and we can talk about it to kick off our next class. But I think the thorn bush represented Abimelech here. And then I think the whole point of this is that Jotham's kind of making the point about production, productivity here. And he's, you know, basically says, well, you know, a productive person, he's too busy to be a leader, you know. And again, I'm trying to paraphrase as best I can of what's going on here. And then he says, basically, through these trees, well, on the other hand, a worthless person, you know, they'd be glad to accept and take the position. But they probably would be destroyed, and the people would be ruled by others. And so Abimelech being like the thorn bush, he could offer Israel no real protection or security. Now, anybody have any quick comments about this? And then, like I say, I want you to read it, and if you've got some additional things next week, let me know. But we bring it at 10 after, is that right? It's 10 or 15 after? 10? Okay. So does anybody have any comments about it? And I know you've read it before, but you probably kind of hit it and maybe haven't thought about it since. But read it. It's a little tricky. I mean, I definitely don't have the answers. Yeah, Ben.
Story of Abimelech is just weird. You know, unlike a lot of the other judges who did mostly good, I mean, Gideon, of course, the end,
sure,
that's a problem. We don't know about some of the others. Abimelech
is a mess.
Really, I mean,
yeah.
Sometimes I wonder why we call him a judge. You know,
yeah.
Because he just does some strange
things. Right. Yeah. For sure. Well, let's leave off here. If you want to read that and see what you think the lessons were that was being taught here, or you know, what we can glean from that, but we see this revelation come true. So if you want to read on down in chapter 9, verse 45, and I'll just read the verse, but it says, "So Abimelech fought against the city all that day. He took the city and killed the people who were in it, and he demolished the city, and so did all in Salt." So this revelation or parable, whatever you want to call it, it came true, okay? We'll leave off there, and we are going to do our best to get through Judges next time. So, thank you for your comments. We'll take a short